We're going to continue our series in just a moment, Understanding the World Gone Mad. Now, I told you last week this was going to be the conclusion, but after studying, I'm just not going to get it in a way that is going to make it compatible and easy to understand. So I'm going to go one more week with it, if that's okay with you. We're talking about understanding the world gone mad. Over the last 3 weeks, we've looked at all the craziness going on, especially in the Middle East, that's now bleeding over into the rest of the world through these jihadists and all this Islamic terrorism that's going on out there by extremists. And we've been looking at a biblical perspective to see why there's so much hatred over there. Why the Jewish people hate the Arabs and the Arabs hate the Jewish people and Islam's at war with everything. And we've seen and documented biblically how all this came to be. Now, I don't have time to look at all that again. And I want to get into what we're going to be talking about today right away. Now, at the end, we've got the notes out there again for those who would like it. So, especially since I'm going to have to move really quickly today, just kind of sit back, put your thinking caps on, and we're going to move. I'm going to jump right ahead. Today, we're going to talk, and we're going to talk the next time about how is all this going to end? How's all this chaos going to end? What ultimately is going to happen? Now, that's going to depend largely, as far as your understanding of that right now, in which particular camp you camp out in. Whether you camp out into the last days according to Jewish people, or the last days according to Muslims, or the last days according to Christians. Now, even in any of those camps, you're not going to get uniformity of agreement across the line. Within any of those, there's going to be some scholars that say this, some scholars that say that. So what we're going to present to you is a general scheme for how things are going to end, how all this chaos is going to end, according to these three different perspectives, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Let's start with Judaism. Now, if you're Jewish today, how do you think everything's going to end? What's going to happen? How will the end of the world come? And what happens after the end of the world? Now, again, there'll be variations, but we're going to look at the Orthodox Jewish perspective. They're still looking for Mashiach to come. Now, they don't use Messiah anymore because of what Christendom has done with that word and relating it to Jesus, but they're looking for Mashiach. Now, Mashiach means the anointed one. There's a word, Mosiach, which means savior. They're not looking for a savior. They're looking for the anointed one in the same way historically that kings of Israel have been anointed by God to lead the people of Israel, to lead the nation of Israel. So what they're looking for is some great political leader to come on the scene. Not going to be divine. It's going to be a human being, going to be a man. Going to live, going to die. But they're looking for a great political leader. He will be a descendant of David, because that's what Scripture promises Israel, that ultimate leader of Israel, that Mashiach would be a descendant of David. He will be very charismatic. This is going to be a guy who will not only attract the interest and the admiration of Jewish people, but he will attract the interest and the admiration of the international community. He's going to be a great judge, and he's going to make righteous decisions. People will follow him, not only because he's charismatic, but because he's just. And in this world of corrupt leadership and politics and all that, that all of us are getting a belly fill no matter where we live, finally, a leader will come on the scene who will be honest, who will be forthright, who will be charismatic, a leader that everyone is going to want to follow. Now, many of them will follow just because of his charisma and his justice, but others will still rebel. And so he will also be a great military leader, and he will defeat all of Israel's enemies. He'll gather all the Jewish exiles around the world back to the land of Israel, the real land of Israel. They'll finally enjoy the biblical dimensions, as we looked at in Genesis chapter 15, of the entire promised land. Some Jewish scholars even believe at this time there'll be a resurrection of the Jewish dead so that they will be able to enjoy this time under Mashiach that will come in. He will build a third temple in Jerusalem, and he will restart the sacrificial system. But it won't be sacrifices for the sins of the nation as it was in Old Testament days. Now it's going to be sacrifices of thanksgiving because Mashiach has finally come and God is finally going to fulfill his promise to his chosen people. He'll establish a government in Israel that will become the center of all governments over the world. Such a charismatic leader, such a great political leader, such a just, honest leader. All nations of the earth will want to follow his leadership. And so finally, Israel will be catapulted to world dominance. Remember, that's why they crucified Jesus, because that's where they were expecting him to do. And when he didn't deliver, they nailed him to a cross. Ultimately, this Mashiach will rule for 1,000 years, a reign of peace and tranquility. No more war, no more terrorism. All of that will be in the past. In fact, there will not be even competing religions any longer, because so convincing, so charismatic, so godly will Mashiach be that all of the other peoples of earth will unanimously come to the conclusion that God Jehovah, the God of Israel, really is the true God. For 1,000 years, everyone will follow in this amazing, amazing life, this reign of Mashiach. Now, ultimately, and there's a lot of confusion about how this is going to happen, ultimately God takes over. And God creates a new heaven and a new earth. And then God executes judgment. It'll be a judgment according to works. It'll be a judgment according to what you've believed about God, according to how you've lived your life, according to whether you were a good person or an evil person. And you will then enter your eternal state. Those who are righteous, those who are good in the eyes of God, will enter a Garden of Eden experience where there'll be peace, no more suffering, abundance of food, festivals, excitement, just this time of enjoying each other in the presence of the Shekinah, the presence of God. For those who were wicked, they will be sent to the place called Gehenna, Sheol, a place of separation. It's going to be two experiences there. For some, this Gehenna experience will be kind of a purgatory experience. It'll be a purifying experience. That when they stood before God in judgment, their life wasn't good enough to immediately allow them into paradise. And so they'll have to go through this purgatory, this Gehenna period of time. That's why it's a common practice for Jewish people when they're praying for deceased people to only pray for them for 11 months. Because surely they weren't bad enough to have to endure the 12 months. But after 12 months, all those who are wicked and who will not be released from Gehenna to join those who are in paradise, their souls, their bodies will be annihilated and they will go into a perpetual state of non-existence. Only the most heinous of characters from human history, according to many Jewish scholars, will continue to suffer for all eternity. So that's what they're expecting. They're looking for it. They're excited about it. They're back in their homeland, and they know that that's exactly what's going to happen. They're already preparing plans for the third temple. They're already recreating the priestly garments to start the sacrificial system. They're poised, they're ready, and they're excited for Mashiach to come. But how about Islam, the other party there in the Middle East, the party that's at war with the Jewish people, the party that is at the center of all of this jihadist terrorism by these Islamic radicals? What do they believe? What do they think is going to happen? Well, it's confusing. Within Islam, there's two books that are considered sacred, two books that are their sacred guidebooks. One is the Quran that you hear about all the time. The Quran from the Islamic perspective, is the revelation by Allah to Muhammad by the angel Gabriel. We talked about it last week. How God, from the Islamic persuasion, sent an angel to Muhammad to tell him that there was one God and not a polytheism of God like was being practiced by the people in Arabia at that time, by the pagans. And he said, you're to destroy paganism and you're to draw the world back to the worship of one God. And over time, he revealed these things to Muhammad, who was illiterate, and he would just recite them to different scribes who ultimately wrote them down. And it became the book that we now know is the Quran. The Quran, amazingly enough, speaks very little about the end times. Has very little guidance there. Except it keeps referring to the hour. The hour. The hour of resurrection. The hour of judgment. The other book is called the Hadith. That book was compiled 200 years after the death of Muhammad. It's a collection of different sayings that people heard Muhammad say during his lifetime and things that he did. And if you look at the Hadith, it'll list a name and it'll talk about what they said Muhammad said. And it'll list another name and it'll talk about what they said Muhammad did. Well, originally, there was over 600,000 of these sayings that allegedly members of his family talked about, and some of his inner circle and some of the other leaders of early Islam. And this Al-Bukhari took all of those and narrowed them down to 7,000 sayings that he believed were genuine, that were genuine sayings, genuine teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. That is what is the Hadith. Again, a name. Listen to what Muhammad taught over and over again. Now, it is from the Hadith, primarily, that we receive what the Islamic eschatology is, the end times according to Islam. Now, they borrow heavily, both the Quran and the Hadith borrow heavily from Hebrew and Christian scripture. Remember, the Bible as we know it today was finalized in around the year 387 AD. Muhammad wasn't even born until 510 AD. So you look at the Quran, you look at the Hadith, you will see many, many familiar sounds and sights and scriptures and words because they're borrowed heavily. The Bible was in circulation then. And later, these folks who produced the Hadith and all that had access to it. And you'll see many parallels. Now, I drew much of what I'm going to share with you right now from two works. One, What Are the End Time Prophecies of Islam by Dr. David R. Regan. And the other one, a book called The Last Trumpet by Dr. Samuel Shaheed. And I did a lot, hours of researching directly Islamic scholars today and what they're teaching. So what I'm going to share with you, although within Islam there's going to be disagreement between this scholar and that scholar and all that, this is a pretty good lineup of what Islam believes, what Muslims believe about how all this chaos is going to end. You ready to go?
Ready.
All right, here we go. From the Islamic perspective, it all starts, all this end time starts moving, starts snowballing radically with the emergence of Dajjal. Dajjal will come. Now, Dajjal is the Islamic counterpart or equivalent of the Christian Antichrist. According to Hadith, he will be born as a Jew, born in Iran, to the parents who have been childless for 30 years. His great distinguishing physical characteristic will be he'll have one eye. Now, today, ISIS, in order to try to recruit jihadists, is circulating pictures of a baby born with one eye, and they're claiming that Dajjal has born. He's in the world now. And that's causing a lot of excitement among the jihadists and among people thinking the end times are coming now, because this is what's going to kick it off. And they're going, hey, things are starting to happen now. I better get right with Allah. I better give this my all right now. And that's one of the recruiting tools that are bringing a lot of these jihadists in it. So he has one eye. He claims initially to be a great prophet. Later, he will claim to be divine. He'll be able to persuade people with eloquent speech. And he'll have the ability to perform miracles. He'll have a great following of people. He'll appear, according to the hadith, at a time when the world is characterized by great godlessness and corruption and immorality. And some of those things they're looking for, look at this. It'll be a time when men will dress like women. There'll be cross-dressers a lot. It'll be a time when homosexuality will abound and be common. They say it'll be a time when children born outside of marriage becomes a commonplace. A time when fornication and adultery is running rampant. A time where there's universal consumption of alcoholic beverages. A time when religious knowledge would disappear. Now you take just those signs and you can start to understand why there's so much excitement within Islam, so much excitement within these jihadists saying, we are living in that day. This is that day. All of that is active in the world today. And you know, when you look at their lifestyle, the Orthodox Muslims, they don't live for that stuff. And they look at the West and say the West is decadent. You know what? They're right. So they're looking for that. That's when Dajjal is going to come. He'll deceive many. He'll have a huge following of people just through his charisma and his ability to communicate and his miracles. Ultimately, he'll become militaristic because his ultimate gain is not just to be a leader. His ultimate gain is to be deified by people, to be worshiped by people. And so ultimately, he will form an army of 70,000 Jews who will join him. Dr. Shahid also mentioned 70,000 Tartars also will be part of this army. The Tartars were Turks, another name for Turks. But anyhow, he'll go out making war against people who are not accepting his message. And he'll be able to have great conquests. He'll go out and conquer the world, but he will not be able to conquer the cities of Medina and Mecca. When he comes there, he's stopped in his tracks by an angel of God, and he's frustrated. You want to have some fun this afternoon? Google Dajjal. They'll take you to a palace right outside of Medina that has been built by the Saudi Arabians, Arab Saudi. And they call it one thing, but all the local people are calling it the Palace of Dajjal, that's where he's going to set up his camp. That's where he's going to be able to see the city. So he's on this rampage. He's besieging Medina. He's trying to carry it on. And the world is really in trouble. His reign is characterized by cruelty. And then Allah intervenes in the person of, get ready for this, Jesus. Jesus will return. Did you know that Jesus is a revered character within Islam? Did you know that? According to Islam, Jesus was never crucified. Jesus never died. According to Islam, Allah transported him out of this world before his enemies could kill him. And he's been with Allah in paradise, waiting for this moment in time. Now he's got to come back because he's a human being and all human beings have to die. So Allah is going to send him back. So Jesus, during this time of great chaos, will return to the Mount of Olives with the purpose of overthrowing Dajjal. Now, many Muslims also believe simultaneously another great Islamic character will arise, and that is Imam Mahdi. Now, when Muhammad died, Islam had a schism. They divided into two sections. Today, you hear about Shiites and Sunnis. Well, the Shiites believe that the leader of Islam must be a blood descendant of Muhammad. The Sunnis, they believe that it should be a leader by consensus of the people. It should be a democratic process, and they should elect who they want to be the leader. And so they're divided. Now, the Shiites believe that Mahdi, they call it the 12th Imam, will come back because he was born like in 800-something A.D., and he's been in hiding since. Allah has kept him hidden. He's going to bring him back for this moment. They believe that he'll come back when the world is at the peak of chaos. Now, Iran is full of Shias. Abinadab, the leader of Iran, is a 12er, they call them. And they believe they can hasten the 12er's return, the 12th Imam's return, by creating even more chaos in the world. That's why they're even more dangerous than ISIS. Because they believe if they get a nuclear weapon, they'll use it. Cause as much chaos as you can. That will start these end time things in earnest. That's where they're coming from. Sunnis, they believe he was just another imam and he may have a part, end times he may not. But anyhow, what happens then? Jesus comes back, Mount of Olives. Allegedly, he meets Imam Mahdi. And the people are excited to see Jesus and they ask him to do the Salat. The Salat is one of the prayers, one of the five pillars of Islam that Muslims have to do every day. And they ask Jesus to lead them in the Salat. But Jesus defers to Mahdi. And he says, no. He says, that's always done by the imams. And so he puts himself subservient. Ultimately, they finish the Salat. Jesus prepares for battle. And they go up now to Damascus, where Dajjal has fled. In Damascus now, they attack him and they force him out of Damascus and they force him back down into Israel. And ultimately, they destroy him at the gate of Lud, which is modern-day Tel Aviv. In fact, the site is where Tel Aviv International Airport is right now. That's ultimately where Jesus and Mahdi, according to Islam, will destroy Dajjal. Now, some within Islam believe that the death of Dajjal will result in the total eradication of the Jewish people from the planet Earth. That when he dies, they all die too because they are the primary followers of Dajjal. Soon after that, two nations of the north, Gog and Magog, make war against Jesus and Mahdi. They come down and try to overthrow Islam. Now, they're not identified who those nations are. But according to the Hadith, these armies are so large that they stop at the Sea of Galilee on their way for the invasion and they drink water. And there's so many soldiers that they drink the Sea of Galilee completely dry. And then they go to war against Jesus and Mahdi. They're so powerful that Jesus can't resist them and his forces. So Jesus, according to the Hadith in Islam, cries out to Allah to save them. And Allah intervenes by sending deadly insects like those in Ezekiel. And some Islam scholars call them worms and disease. But anyhow, Allah intervenes and destroys the armies of Gog and Magog. When that happens, Jesus begins to reign. Jesus declares that Islam is the true religion, that Allah is the true God. Not most Christians convert to Islam. He then becomes the sole leader of the earth, leading an Islamic theocracy, ruling over the world, again, with justice, peace. See, they agree with the Jewish people that he'll be a person of peace and justice, a good leader. Jesus will live for 40 years. And during that 40 years, he'll go to Mecca to do the pilgrimage rituals every year. At the age of 20 years old, Jesus will marry and he'll have children. Then 19 years later, he'll die and he will be buried next to Muhammad in Medina awaiting the great resurrection. When Jesus dies, it's held by many Islamic scholars that all believers will die. Now, some say that this cool breeze will come upon the earth and the cool breeze will peacefully and gracefully take the life of all believers. Now, within Islam, they believe there's actually two judgments. The first judgment is immediately after you die. You're met by two angels, Munkar and Nakir. And they do kind of a preliminary screening with you. And they decide, well, after they take a look at your life and they think you're probably going to make it into paradise, then your grave is an open grave. And you wait the day of the resurrection in bliss. If they kind of look at your life and say, don't think you're going to make it, you're put into a grave that's constricting. And your waiting period is filled with torture and suffering and pain. Unbelievers, once all the believers are gone, will be left on earth to suffer the ravages that are about to come. Those come in several appearances. One is the appearance of the beast, and he's a good beast. And he comes and he tries to persuade these unbelievers one more time to put their faith in Allah and Islam is the one true religion, the one true God. For those who refuse, he stamps infidel on their forehead. Another period of suffering comes when a great smoke arises from the earth and engulfs all the earth. And this smoke brings intense suffering upon all the inhabitants of the earth. Another form of suffering comes from three landslides, three great earthquakes, three great landslides. One will happen in the east, one will happen in the west, and one will happen in Arabia, to where massive chaos, massive loss of life will occur in these horrendous, horrendous landslides. Then there'll be a miracle of nature that will occur, and this is the sign. This is the sign that everything's about ready to come to an end. That miracle of nature will be this, that the sun will not rise in the east, but the sun will rise in the west. Then Allah will begin to gather all the people on earth for the final hour. He'll use a great fire that will break out in the Hadith south of Eden, in the country that we know today as Yemen. And the fire will consume all the land and will literally herd the people of earth to the place that Allah wants him to be for the time of his appearing and for the time of judgment. Once that fire has herded all the people there, trumpets will sound. Now, according to what kind of line of thinking you are in Islam, some believe there's three trumpets. Many believe there's only two trumpets. But the first trumpets that sound are the trumpet of terror and the trumpet of swoon. Now again, many in Islam, a good deal of Islamic scholars believe that the same one, there's only one. It's the trumpet of terror, trumpet of swoon. And then there's the next trumpet I'm going to tell you about. But the trumpet of terror sounds and it just strikes terror into the lives and the minds of all these people who have now been assembled by this great fire. Then shortly after or simultaneously, depending on the scholar you're reading, the trumpet of swoon. Now the trumpet of swoon, the trumpet of terror, the sound is so intense, it's so loud that according to the Hadith, it will literally kill every living thing in the universe, both things in heaven and things on earth. It'll kill everything. At that time, Allah will cry out, "I am the mighty one," three times. He alleged, according to Hadith, will call out, "To whom does the kingdom belong today? It belongs to the one God, the conqueror." At the same time, he's going to create a new heaven and a new earth. No one understands exactly how long that time is between those trumpets and the final trumpet. But in the meantime, many who believe that not only will all life end, but that all physical matter will end, and that Allah will completely destroy the universe, planets, everything, and then make that new heavens and new earth. In the voidness of space, he'll cry those cries out, and when there's no answer, and the new heavens and the new earth is formed, the final trumpet will blow the trumpet of resurrection. While he's creating a new heaven, new earth, he'll also energize the bodies of the dead to begin coming back into their physical bodies. That third trumpet of resurrection will sound, and the day of resurrection will arise. Muhammad will be the first person resurrected, and then all of humanity will be resurrected. Everyone will initially be barefoot, naked and uncircumcised. Now, this caused a lot of concern with many, many Muslims. Because remember, under Islam, to look on someone else's nakedness is a horrible sin. It's a terrible shame. And so I saw many of these folks writing into some of these imams and saying, but if that happens, then we're going to be looking at each other's nakedness. And how's that? And the imams respond something like this, that at that moment, every individual will be so consumed with his or her personal welfare standing before Allah that they're not going to notice anybody around them in any condition. So they come before Allah. Abraham first is clothed by Allah. And he's seated in a place of honor in a chair facing the throne of Allah. Then Muhammad comes, and he's the second one to be clothed by Allah. And he takes his place in a place of honor at the right hand of Allah. And then it continues. Between that resurrection and the next step, there's a day of reckoning. From the Islamic persuasion, that day of reckoning will be characterized by a time of toil, a time of suffering, both physically and psychologically for everyone. Now, the believers, Muslims, in that situation, their suffering will be far, 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 far less than the suffering of the unbelievers who have been resurrected. How long the day lasts, we don't know. Many of the scholars, some of the hadiths suggest that that day can be as long as 50,000 years. But this time goes on until finally Allah brings judgment. Allah himself will descend and he will judge all humanity and the jinns. Now the jinns are a special classification of people in Islamic literature that live in a parallel existence to human beings. They live a life much like human beings. They get married, they have children, they die, and they will stand judgment. But they live in a parallel existence that is invisible to human beings. But the jinns have supernatural powers, and they're going to be largely judged on how they use those powers. And one of their powers is they have the ability to transform themselves into any human object. Human being, a tree, a plant, a goat, anything. And most of the time, the jinns use that for the purpose of evil, and the chief jinn is Satan. So they'll be judged, and all humanity will judge. And you will be judged by for two things: how you responded to the prophet and the word of the prophet, and how you lived your life. This is literally going to be good works, bad works, and your whole life will be judged, and your ultimate eternal destination will be determined by your life. Once all the judgment has done, all mankind, starting with Muhammad, he'll be the first, will have to cross a bridge that spans the new earth and heaven with hell in the abyss. All unbelievers who have been judged to be unbelievers will not be able to make it across the bridge, and they'll fall off the bridge into the abyss of hell. But even believers will cross the bridge in fear, because from the Islamic perspective, Allah is such an arbitrary God that he just might change his mind on your way across the bridge and condemn you to hell anyhow. So no matter who you are, even Muhammad himself said, I don't know if Allah will be favorable with me. There is no hope. Even the final steps are taken in abject fear. Once the believers successfully get to the other side, they'll gather by the pool of the prophet. Finally, they'll get to drink from the pool of prophet, and their tongue will finally be quenched from all the suffering that the day of reckoning had brought upon everyone. From there, a great intercession will take place. Muhammad will start to intercede with Allah for the believers and beg Allah to allow them into paradise. And he'll be begging him. There's no indication of how much time this intercession will take place, but he'll beg him and beg him and beg him. Finally, Allah will relent and allow them into paradise. At the same time, simultaneously, there's another intercession going on. The other intercession is by the prophets and by the martyrs and by the believers. They're interceding with Allah for the souls and the lives of the people who have been in hell. And they plead with Allah, if there's just an atom of faith, if there's just a smidgen of faith, Allah, surely you wouldn't condemn them to this. And at some point, Allah sweeps his hand down into hell and brings up a group of people out of hell and allows them to enter paradise as a sign that he's a merciful God. From there, people begin their eternal experience in paradise. Heaven itself is reserved for Allah and Muhammad. The next heaven down is for Adam. Then you start going down through all these Old Testament prophets, even into the New Testament. One is for Jesus and John the Baptist. Then finally you get down to the common paradise for most people, most Muslims, and it's called the Garden of Eden, basically, where they enter into a time of feasting and celebration and peace and no suffering and just enjoying life. And the ordinary Muslim man gets 40 perpetual virgins, and the martyrs, the jihadists, they get, you've heard about the 72 perpetual virgins. And within this eternal situation, again, they are perpetual virgins, and all the sexual restraints that have been placed on them during this lifetime are removed, and they're enjoyed just to enjoy eternity with their perpetual journey. Now, interesting enough, those in hell also have levels. And the first level is kind of another purgatory level for Muslims who just did not make it across the bridge. And at some point in time, they'll be excused. The next level down is for Christians. The next level down is for Jews. And then down onward through different people and different characteristics of how they've lived this life. Many Muslim scholars believe that when Allah sweeps his hand down and brings them up, that he's going to bring up everyone who was monotheistic, who believed in one God in one form or another. And it's only going to be the polytheists that endure hell forever and ever, and the most heinous characters of history. Now, ladies, here's one you're not going to like. Muhammad taught vehemently that most of the occupants in hell would be women. Now, this is a guy who had 15 wives, so I don't know. You know. So, is that the end? Is that really how it ends? Is that reality? What does Scripture have to say about it? What does God have to say about it? See you next time. And I was promised a praise team, but I think the jinns got them. Come on, lead us really quickly in a closing song. Thank you for being here today. Next week, come back for that great celebration. But listen, one thing is true. Of no matter what religious system that we're talking about, one thing everyone espouses to, and that's the fact that there is life after this life. There is a judgment to come, and we need to be ready for that. If you have any insecurity of where you're going to spend eternity, do not leave this campus like that. Come and see me in the lobby after. Come and see one of our pastors, one of our deacons, someone at one of the booths, and we'll get with you and show you that you can have the promise of God in your life, the promise of eternity. As you leave today, don't forget your final act of worship, and that's the giving of our tithes and offerings. Let's give as a thanksgiving offering to the Lord to show him our love to him and our trust in him. Let's stand and let's close out praising God one more time.